Welcome to another virtual author chat at the Poison Pen Bookstore. I'm John Charles, and today the Poison Pen special guest author is Jennifer Coburn, whose new book is Cradles of the Reich. Before we begin today, I'd like to let those listening in know that the Poison Pen does have copies of Jennifer's new book, and we will be delighted to hold one for you or put one in the mail. Just give us a call or go online to the Poison Pen. And now I would like to welcome Jennifer Coburn.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for taking time to meet with us today. My first question for authors, just as a reader, is I'm always fascinated by their life before they were a writer, because almost everyone has something that they've done before they decided to write a book. So what would you like to tell us about Jennifer before you became a published author?
Well, I've always been a storyteller and I've always been a writer, but I also worked in public relations at Planned Parenthood, which is where I first it really sparked my interest in reproductive rights and women's reproductive agency, which is a main theme of Cradles of the Reich.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know Cradles of the Reich is your eighth book, so you've had some other books before that. What was your initial path to publication like? Because your early titles are more contemporary women's fiction.
Right. They are romantic comedies. Okay. And my last book was called We'll Always Have Paris, which was a travel memoir that followed my daughter Katie and me around 12 European cities. So writing a book about Nazis was not the next natural career step for me. But when I heard about the Lebensborn breeding program that the Nazis launched during World War II, or prior to and during World War II, I just had to write this book because I had so many questions about this program, like, you know, how many homes were there and how were the women selected and why? Why would women volunteer to have sex with strangers just to have a baby for the Reich? So that's why I made the hard, hard left to writing about, to historical fiction.
Now, if I understand correctly, what initially sparked the idea was you were watching a television show?
Yeah, I was watching a show called The Man in the High Castle, which is based on the Philip K. Dick novel of the same name. And the show imagines a dystopian 1962 after the Nazis have won the war. And there were a lot of disturbing elements in the show, but one that really caught my attention was when this beautiful German woman said that she was bred through the Lebensborn Society. And I said, okay, that's definitely fiction, because there were a lot of fictional things in that show. But then I Googled Lebensborn. This was late at night. I Googled Lebensborn, a black and white photo of a row of nurses standing in an almost military formation holding these little babies appeared. And then I started digging, and then I saw the sunrise outside my window, and I realized I was not going to be able to let this fascination go before I wrote this book.
And the book itself, you kind of tell the story through three different characters. Can you tell us a little bit about those three women?
Yeah, you bet. The three women represent the three choices that non-Jewish German women had in 1939. There is Gundi, who is the resistor. She's a 20-year-old university student who is everything that the Nazis consider perfect. She's blonde, she has blue eyes, she's beautiful, and she's tall. What the Nazis don't know about her is that she is pregnant with a Jewish man's baby. So she reluctantly or is coerced to the Lebensborn home. There she meets Irma. Irma is a nurse for the Lebensborn Society, and she is, like a lot of German women, a bystander. She just wants to keep her head down. And when she goes to work for the Lebensborn home, she kind of feels like she's doing a good thing for her country and for the women that are in this program. Then there is Hilda. Hilda is the Nazi true believer, which sadly, there were many. Hilda is what the Germans called a real Hitler girl. And she buys in completely to Hitler's agenda. She's also pregnant with a high-ranking Nazi officer's baby. And she's excited about this, and she is proud to claim her place in the Reich. So those are the three women. And because they have such different views on the Reich, their wants and their needs are at odds with each other.
Yeah, it's a very fascinating story, because you really do see different sides to this issue, even some that you wouldn't want to necessarily see. You kind of are exposed to them. The program itself began in 1935, is that correct?
Yes.
And it went through the war, or what was the kind of path of progression of this?
Yeah, it was a top secret program that Heinrich Himmler introduced in 1935, and it went through the war in 1945, when the war ended. So Himmler had this idea that he was going to create 2 million racially valuable babies for the Reich. And the first thing that he did was open up these maternity homes for women who were already pregnant, women of the racial pedigree that they were looking for, already pregnant, and the abortion was illegal for Aryan women. And he wanted to give them a place where they could carry out their pregnancy in privacy and no shame. And then they would give up those children to quote unquote good German families. So that was the first track. Then, excuse me, I have a little bit of a frog in my throat this morning.
That's okay.
Then the Nazis began setting up sexual liaisons between blonde hair, blue eyed women and SS officers. And then when the war began in 1939, soldiers on the ground were instructed to identify racially valuable children in countries that the Nazis occupied and steal them. And in the end, the Lebensborn Society bred 20,000 babies for the program, and they kidnapped 200,000 children, half of whom were from Poland alone.
It's just amazing when you stop and think about it, it's things many of us never really knew about this part of history, between this program to breed what they considered the right kids. And I guess the Nazis were also getting rid of children and babies that did not fit their standards of what they thought was acceptable. I think Susan Meisner did a book recently that was all about, well, not all about it, but touched upon how they just ruthlessly exterminated people that didn't fit their.
Yeah, and I would like to highly recommend to your listeners Only the Beautiful by Susan Meisner. It is exquisite, and it's a look at the eugenics program in the United States. In Germany, as we all know, the Nazis launched a eugenics program that would rid the world of Jews and other Untermenschen, which is what they considered subhumans, Romani, homosexuals, intellectuals, communists, social misfits as they saw them. So that was one of the things that really fascinated me about Lebensborn, is we all know about the genocide that the Nazis perpetrated. But what I didn't know before studying this was that there was a flip side of the coin where they were trying to repopulate or populate the world with what they considered perfect people, or as Susan calls them, only the beautiful.
Mm-hmm. So you decided to write a historical novel. It was your first historical novel. Obviously you had to do more research than Google. So can you talk a little bit about what kinds of sources you used? If I remember correctly, it's challenging because a lot of records and things were destroyed during the war. So you had to really do different kinds of research.
And a lot of the records on the Lebensborn program were destroyed. When I do talks, people say, hey, weren't the Nazis excellent record keepers? And they were meticulous about keeping records. What they were also very efficient at is burning them at the end of the war, because they knew that they would be used as evidence in war crimes trials. So what I did for research is a lot of the things that you would guess. I read books, I watched documentary films, I read academic papers, but what I found most helpful was consulting with subject matter experts and people who were there in Germany at the time. So I knew that things like the Battle of the Bezerra, or dates that Germany invaded different countries, or non-aggression pacts, I knew that was all well documented. What was harder, and what came up on every page of this book, were these mundane cultural details, like when a man in 1939 Germany puts on his pants, does he button, snap, or zip them? That was really hard to find out. So I had a 92-year-old man who grew up in Germany and now lives in San Diego, and he told me I could call on him for details like, okay, so I called on Rolf when I had a scene and I said, hey, Rolf, I have Irma remembering when her beloved Helmut proposed marriage to her, and they're at that gorgeous Fountain of Justice in Frankfurt. And I was thinking it would be sweet if Helmut tossed a coin, just a pfennig, into the fountain and made a wish. Do you Germans do that? And he said, wait one moment, why is someone throwing away money? And I said, no, just a pfennig. And he said, now you listen to me. If you have a German throwing away a coin, your next scene had better be six Germans jumping into that fountain to fight for the coin. I also reached out to the German author, Bernhard Schlenk, and he wrote The Reader. And he was kind enough to offer to read my manuscript for linguistic and cultural authenticity. And he said to me, hey, Jennifer, you keep using the term bumsen as a slang for sex. However, we Germans did not use bumsen until 1952. Before that, it was rumsen. So, like, John, where am I going to find that in a history book? That is where you need people who had their feet on the ground during that time. I also consulted with architectural historians, food historians, historians of propaganda, to make sure that the details, the posters that were on the walls, the food that they were eating. Like, I had one scene where the Germans were eating cubed cheese, and my food historian said, why are they eating why are they cutting it in cubes? That's frivolous, mm-hmm. Which I found was a word that they used a lot, frivolous. Anyway, there were tons and dozens of people who helped me get the details right. And I am just so grateful that they took the time and energy and shared their expertise to help me tell this story with the accuracy and detail that readers deserve.
You've really done a fascinating job. There are things that I never realized or thought about, but I think at one point in your research, you had to find out whether or not German people ate popcorn at the movies, and you never would have thought about, I mean, you just assume that everyone would do that, but they don't.
No, they didn't eat popcorn at the movies. And when I asked this group of older German women, they were utterly confused, like, why is there corn? And what is popcorn? They were in their 80s and 90s. One of the food details that I found fascinating was, I had this scene where Hilda comes in chapter two, and she smells that her mother is cooking Hasenpfeffer, which is a braised hare stew. So I called Ursula Heinzelmann, who is the food historian I consulted with, and I said, hey, you know what? This scene is happening in April, and stew is kind of like a hearty winter meal. Is that plausible? And that is, John, when I realized that I was asking the wrong question. It wasn't about stew, because as Ursula told me, Germans eat stew all year round. The real question is, where are they going to find a rabbit when rabbit hunting season ends in December? And this scene is happening in April. So then I had to rework the scene so that Hilda has this line of internal dialogue where she wonders, I wonder where Mama found a rabbit that was plump and juicy enough to use in a Hassan pepper. Because Ursula told me that that because rabbit hunting season ended in December, the only rabbit that they would have in April would be stringy and skinny because they had just come out of hibernation. So that's 7.5 hours of research for one tiny detail, what amounted to one line of internal dialogue in the book.
It's amazing that if you don't put that time in, it comes back to smack you because somebody will find something in the book and say this was not historically correct or this was not accurate.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Same thing with the travel. You have to plan out their travel routes and then, you know, I know how long it takes to get someplace now by train, but the trains didn't move at the same speed as they did back then.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing how much went into it. What surprised you the most when you were doing the research? What did you discover that you thought, this just totally amazes me?
So two things really amazed me. And one was the level of propaganda. I did not know how deep it went. I didn't know there were board games, propagandic board games. I knew that there were children's stories, and I knew that there were posters and films, but I didn't know that they were targeting children so, so young. What really blew my mind was that the Nazis had a medal that they gave to mothers who had four or more children, either through birth or through adoption. Was called the Mutter Cross, which means the Mother Cross. And it was a war medal. It was a service medal that women were awarded for having, they got a brass one or a bronze one for four children. Silver, they got for six or more children, and they would receive a gold medal if they had eight or more children. Now, you would wonder, like, all right, so is a woman really going to have eight children just to get one of these medals? Mm-hmm. And the answer is absolutely, because it was such a status symbol to walk around with this medal that when these women were in their communities, members of the Hitler Youth and the girls' arm of the Hitler Youth, the Bunderdusche Mädel, when they saw these women with a medal like this, they had to stop and salute her as if she were the Führer himself. Yeah. So that really, that level of, you know, I don't want to say commitment because it sounds like I'm praising them for something positive, but I guess that level of fanaticism blew me away. Yeah. And it really shouldn't have because the Nazis perpetrated a mass genocide, but they never failed. During the research, I was just continually amazed at the different facets of their propagandic campaigns.
I think that's one of the important things about novels like yours and other books is if we don't remember history, if we tend to put it aside or don't want to address it, it's too easily lost and we end up repeating it in cycles that go through. I mean, there's a lot going on today with people who are concerned about people who are not like them and concerns about how they want to make everyone conform. It's almost scary, the parallels.
Oh, it's very scary. There were times when my jaw dropped and I had to put down a textbook because I felt like I was reading a modern newspaper rather than the story of the rise of fascism in Germany mm-hmm. or Europe, really.
Yeah. And despite the fact that it's a very serious topic and it needs to be treated seriously, you're also writing a novel, so you don't want readers to be completely devastated by the end of the book. So you have to give them something to kind of hold on to. And I think one of the things that you did really well was The book is also about how women can use the connections they make to kind of get through difficult times, to maybe mm-hmm. become better versions of themselves. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I wanted to write a book that addressed the Lebensborn Society, but the real message that I wanted to convey in this story was that when women are faced with unspeakably difficult circumstances, the connections that they forge with one another can help them rise, help us rise to heroism that they never knew they were capable of. So I wanted each of the characters to go through somewhat of a transformation, to really become more of who they were. Now, my Nazi character does not have she does not have an awakening. And the reason that I chose to do that is because she is a representative of Germany. And to have her realize, oh, this is wrong and what I'm doing is bad, is unrealistic and almost disrespectful to the 10 million people who were killed by the Nazis, because there wasn't that revelation. And I didn't want, so she goes from bad to worse. But the other two characters, one becomes more effective in her heroism, and one wakes up and sees there's one part where Irma, who goes through the most dramatic transformation, she has this moment where she sees soldiers, and for the first time, she does not feel comforted by the sight of them. She feels frightened by the sight of them. And that's when she really knows that she has had her worldview changed.
One of the things I wanted to talk to you about is, because you've written your first historical novel, is historical fiction something you as a reader gravitate towards in your reading life? And I think fiction tends to come and go in cycles. We see it through different genres, but the last 20 years, there's been a renewed interest, I think, in a lot of readers in historical fiction. Why do you think historical fiction is so popular?
Well, the first part of your question, I love historical fiction. I wish I had discovered historical fiction in high school, because it is a wonderful way to learn about history. When my high school and college professors would hand me a textbook and all it had was dates and battles and treaties, it didn't pull me in. I love hearing about the stories of women and how they navigated complex times. So I can only speak for myself. That's why I love historical fiction. And it is a very popular genre. And when I talk to readers, they say they really like historical fiction too. The readers that I talk to say about half of their reading list is historical. People are very interested in World War II, very interested now in the 1950s mm-hmm. and the Cold War, the McCarthy era. It's really interesting to people, and I can see why.
Yeah.
You know what I wish, John? I wish my high school teachers had said to me, write a 15-page story set in the time that we are studying, because I have learned more about history by having to write it mm-hmm. than I ever did reading a textbook, that is.
Yeah, you've just done an amazing amount of work on researching this novel, so that shows in the authenticity. Was it a challenge? You've gone to it from fiction to historical fiction, striking the right balance, because it can be hard to write a historical novel and not want to include every single thing you've learned in it. You have to also keep the story moving.
Okay, well, clearly you have been eavesdropping on conversations with my editor and me, because just an hour ago I was on the phone and my editor said, you are trying to shoehorn in everything that you've learned about, I'm writing a book set in the Theresienstadt ghetto, which was the Nazis' propaganda camp, their show camp. And there are so many crazy things that they did in the making of this propaganda film and in preparation for the Red Cross inspection that happened in 1944. So I'm finding out so many things that happened that I want to stuff into the story that don't move the story forward. So that is hard. And yes, it is very, very challenging. And I'm going through now and pulling out huge pieces of information that I thought were fascinating. And I know the reader would find fascinating, but they do not move the story forward. So yeah, that's a big, big, big challenge for me.
You have written a number of books now. If you had the opportunity to go back when you were starting your first novel, knowing what you know now, what advice would you give yourself?
I would say, don't compare your draft to somebody else's published book, because my draft, and I think when writers are being honest, they will admit that their drafts are a hot mess, a less hot mess, a warm mess, and then they evolve into something that is publishable. Well, I used to write a draft and I would think that it was supposed to be in perfect condition. And then I would read somebody else's novel, you know, that I bought at a bookstore, and I'd go, oh my gosh, this is so great. They're so much better than me. I'm a hack. I'm horrible. And I would spend a lot of time and energy beating myself up and not realizing that they probably went through the same level of angst and revision that I did.
Let's see, in addition to telling stories, writing stories as a creative outlet, if I understand correctly, you've also become an avid story listener. Can you tell us a little bit about your involvement in a group called So Say We All?
Oh, yes. So Say We All is a nonprofit organization here in San Diego. And it's a lot like the Moth, which is a national organization maybe some of your listeners are familiar with, but it's live storytelling. People get up and tell 10-minute stories, true stories, at the microphone. And it's not open mic. It is something that they have to submit. They have to be selected for, and then they go through about a 3-week boot camp before the story is ready to be told. Well, these people tell you stories that, man, you have no right to know, but they are brave souls, and they get up and tell you about the most intimate details of their life, the most joyous, the most challenging, the most painful, the most humiliating things that have ever happened to them. And you learn so much about the human condition that I always feel like I walk out of a So Say We All performance a better person, reminded to have compassion, reminded that everybody has a story that you don't know about, and that they've had things that have happened in their lives that really, if we knew about, we would give them a break. Mm-hmm. So I go every month to just keep myself remembering that people have gone through a lot. Yeah. And some of the stories are just hilarious, mm-hmm. and some of them are just heartbreaking. And the best ones are both. Best ones are when they just you're laughing, and then all of a sudden they just sucker punch you and you're crying.
That's amazing. You kind of mentioned you're working on another project. Do you want to tell us any more about that, or would you prefer to keep it under wraps?
No, I'd love to tell you about it. It's called The Girls of the Glimmer Factory. And it is set in the Theresienstadt ghetto, which the Nazis set up as their propaganda camp. It was in operation in northern Czechoslovakia for 3.5 years, and it was a so-called privileged camp. Now, it was a slave labor camp, and the prisoners were given starvation rations, and most of them were deported to death camps in the East. But they used this as the Nazis used this as a place to show the global community that the Jews were being treated wonderfully. They made a propaganda movie here. And then when the global community started saying, like, hey, you know what, we're hearing about death camps and gas chambers, they said, oh, no, come to Theresienstadt and see how wonderful it is. And there were a lot of artists who were sent to Theresienstadt. So there was a vibrant cultural community. There were operas and symphonies and lectures every single day. So as one prisoner described it, it was heaven and it was hell. So that fascinated me. And I want to take the stories of two women, one who was the heroine, the Jewish prisoner who was sent to Theresienstadt, and Hilda from Cradles of the Reich, who is now a filmmaker for the Reich, and she is part of the crew who goes to Theresienstadt to make the film.
Oh. And do you have a projected publication date, or is it still in the works?
Well, I'm told it'll be January or March of 2025, but that could change.
That certainly could, yeah. Is there a way that readers can find out more about your books? Do you have a website? Are you on social media platforms?
Yes to both. My website is jennifercoburn.com, and I'm really active on social media, Instagram and Facebook. It's Jennifer Coburn Books. And what they will see most recently is my research trip to Terezin, which is the town that Theresienstadt was in. And just, boy, I think like 10 days ago, I was in Terezin doing research for the next book. And I have lots of pictures and some just serendipitous meetings that I had with groups of students who were also doing research projects about Theresienstadt. So that's, I think, really interesting information on my social media pages.
That's great. I can't believe how quickly our time has just flown by. We've been very fortunate at The Poison Pen to have author Jennifer Coburn with us talking about her new book, Cradles of the Reich. I'd like to thank you, Jennifer, for taking time to be with us today. And for those tuning in, thank you for joining us for another author chat at The Poison Pen Bookstore.
Well, the pleasure has been all mine. Thank you.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.